Well, now it's time to welcome back Brian Hughes, who I'm sure, as you know by now, is consultant solicitor of Shenfield-based solicitor firm Rayner Hughes. Now, the last time you were here, Brian, you tackled the subject of management and service charges, something which is clearly an issue close to your heart. And today you're kind of returning to the issue as, in as much as you're looking at service charges. Now, I don't know when I'm going to say this right. You've already ticked me off once. Paid by tenants who own leasehold properties, but I think it's a little bit more than that, isn't
it? Yes, it is indeed.
Yes, I got it all wrong.
Yeah. Nowadays, in fact, some developers impose service charges on freeholders where in an estate there are common areas like gardens or green spaces or private roads. Mm. So it's sort of creeping into freeholds as well. But we're going to stick to leaseholds today.
Okay. But why have you chosen to come back to this subject again?
Well, Scott, I realise that I've talked quite a lot about leases already, but more and more people are buying leasehold flats and maisonettes these days. Young people are buying them because that's all they can afford. And old people are buying them because they want to spend their old age in properties which they don't have to maintain themselves. They want to leave that particular responsibility to others. Many elderly people also prefer not to have the hassle of maintaining a garden with all that entails, and choose a flat or apartment built specifically for people over a certain age, usually 55, where the maintenance of gardens and communal facilities is included in what are called service charges.
Okay, so just what do these service charges cover then, apart from the sorting out the garden?
Firstly, they cover not only the cost of maintaining the exterior of the building, of which the flat, maisonette or apartment forms part, but also a number of other costs as well, such as the maintenance of any communal central heating system, the cost of employing gardeners, of maintaining car parking and communal areas like paths and staircases, and of servicing lifts within the building. Perhaps less obvious is the cost of employing managing agents to manage the building, and a firm of accountants to produce annual service charge accounts, and the potential legal costs involved in recovering unpaid service charges from other tenants, which does happen. Naturally, any landlord quite rightly expects his tenants to cover all these costs in accordance with the terms set out in their lease.
And are there areas from which the landlord can profit in this?
No. The only profit a landlord is expected to make out of the building is the rent. Mm-hmm. But what I want to emphasise is that most people don't appreciate the ongoing expense involved in buying a leasehold property. As I've said in previous programmes, a lease is a contract to occupy a space within a building for a number of years. And the landlord, whoever that may be at the end of the term, should take the building back in the state that it was in at the beginning of the term. Most landlords won't be alive to take back the building when their leases end, but that's the basis upon which leases are granted.
Okay, so what factors can affect the service charges?
The first, obviously, is the age and state of the building in which the leasehold property is situate. The older the building, the higher will be the cost of maintaining it, and the more the tenant will be called upon to pay. The second is the competency of the landlords or their managing agents. Some managing agents are very good and offer an efficient and low-cost service, but others seem to regard being managing agents as a way of printing money.
Okay, so whilst the landlord can't profit from these service charges, a management agent can make money on the side, possibly due to their own incompetence, or maybe it is simply as a way of fleecing the tenant. Are there any measures a tenant can take to prevent him being fleeced in that manner?
Yes, there are. But before we get on to that, I should perhaps also mention another factor which may well be covered in the lease, and that's the level of services which may be provided within the building. For example, some blocks of flats, particularly in London, offer porter facilities, lifts, and even swimming pools. If no reserve fund has been built up to cover the cost of replacement, that cost will fall upon the leaseholder tenant at the time the expense is incurred.
Okay, but that doesn't sound very fair. What is there to stop tenants being overcharged? And what if the landlord decides to retile the roof or repaint all the external paintwork, woodwork, or does something else really expensive and there's no reserve fund. What happens if the tenants at that time are faced with a massive bill that they can't afford?
Well, Scott, these scenarios have arisen many times in the past, and governments have brought in legislation to protect residential tenants. And that's where the 1985 Landlord and Tenant Act comes in. What the government have said is that although a landlord or managing agent doesn't have to accept the least expensive quote for work to be carried out on a building, a residential tenant need only pay service charge costs to the extent that they are reasonably incurred, and where they are incurred in connection with the provision of services or the carrying out of works, the services or works are of a reasonable standard.
Well, okay, that says maybe, but how does a tenant challenge the costs or the standard of the works? And what happens if, as a tenant, you feel you're being ripped off by your landlords or managing agents because the works or services are not of a sufficiently good standard?
If they're not of a reasonable standard, yeah. Well, any tenant may challenge their service charges by applying to the property chamber of what is called the first tier tribunal. The reasonableness of costs for works or services may even involve considering the tenant's ability to pay, or whether, importantly, the managing agents have slipped the cost of improvements into the service charges. The tenant's means are usually irrelevant to the issue of whether the costs are reasonably incurred, but they may well be relevant if the repair costs, for example, replacing or resurfacing a roof or installing replacement windows, are unexpectedly high. The tenant's circumstances might well impact on when and how to effect such repairs. As for improvements, as far as they're concerned, the financial impact on the tenant is, in the view of the property tribunal, relevant where improvement goes beyond what is required to effect a repair.
Is that it? Are there any other protections?
Yes, there are. And they're also contained in the 1985 Landlord and Tenant Act. For residential tenants, Section 20 of the Act gives them rights to be consulted on service charge costs in certain circumstances. The requirement to be consulted is triggered where any works of repair, maintenance, or improvement to a building or other premises are proposed, and any leaseholder would be obliged to contribute more than £250 in any accounting period, or where the landlord proposes to enter into an ongoing maintenance or service contract of more than a year in duration, where any leaseholder would be obliged to contribute more than £100 in any accounting period. A landlord can't slip a management company between itself and the tenants, incidentally, and avoid the requirements of the Act by making the tenant an under-tenant. In that case, it's the residential sub-tenants who have the right to be consulted.
It's very complicated, isn't it? Whilst it may be true that a tenant does have a fair amount of leverage to ensure that landlords act in a reasonable manner, it's crucial that they are fully aware of the rights they have, isn't it?
Well, absolutely spot on. Unless the landlord serves the necessary statutory notices under the 1985 Act, a failure by the landlord to adequately consult his tenants would expose him to a maximum recovery of £100 per leaseholder for long-term contracts, or £250 for other works per leaseholder per year. The only way a landlord can get round the Act is to apply to the same property chamber of the first-tier tribunal and ask for a dispensation, which the tribunal may grant if it's satisfied that it's reasonable to do so. But the tribunal will almost certainly impose conditions that mitigate the impact on the tenants. I've not got time to go into service charges in any detail, but landlords are expected to issue budgets at least 1 month prior to the start of the service charge year. And Section 20B of the Act, 1985 Act, provides that a residential tenant is not liable to pay service charge costs incurred if any of those relevant costs were incurred 18 months before a demand for payment or written notification was made. The advice I have to give to every tenant is just this: consult your local legal advisor and make sure that your landlord or tenant or managing agent is complying with the 1985 Act.
Well, what can I say, Brian? Thanks again for all of that. And although you say you've not gone into any detail, it seems pretty comprehensive to me. So what have you decided to talk about next time around?
Well, I'm going to discuss or mention the nuts and bolts of service charges next time round, because I think we've got to clear up this particular area completely for the listener.
Right.
Okay. And then after that, we'll move on to something else.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you very much indeed, Brian.